Okay, good morning. You are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LEB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. The Lab is located here in Lowell, Massachusetts, and us readers read the local news, the editorials, the feature stories, and more. The Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers, which I am a volunteer, and I want to say good morning to Paul, also a volunteer.
Yes, good morning, David. Good morning, everyone out there. Supposed to be a warm week this week, so it's starting off a little cloudy, but supposed to be 80 tomorrow, or?
I'm playing golf tomorrow.
Oh, nice.
First time. So Paul and I are going to read the local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. The Lab Radio is brought to you by, again, volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. The Lab would also like to thank Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue for the charitable foundation for their support. And Paul is going to read today's Lowell Sun. That's Monday, April 13. I'm going to read to you from the Lowell Sun, the Sunday paper, April 12. And I see Paul's already had his first gulp of water, so I assume he's ready to go.
Yes, 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 we are. So I might as well start off with the big front page story here, which I out of Lowell, which I didn't hear about myself. And there's a picture of some trees and firefighters on ladders putting out a fire, which apparently looks like it was a brush fire of some type. And the headline is Blaze Guts a Power Station. A fire tore through a hydroelectric power station at the northern tip of the Wamasit Canal on Sunday afternoon, collapsing the building's interior and causing damage believed to be beyond repair. The blaze was first reported as a brush fire by a passerby who noticed the flames and went to the Lawrence Street Firehouse to alert firefighters. Deputy Fire Chief James Normandin said Engine 11 and Ladder 1 reported at about 1 p.m. on Sunday to find flames not only burning through nearby brush, but overtaking the power station at 670 Lawrence Street in Lowell. Normandin said the building's roof caved in and the interior collapsed within 5 to 10 minutes of firefighters arriving. Firefighters had to contend with a difficult water supply. The nearest hydrant was several hundred feet away, forcing crews to stretch long hose lines to establish a steady flow of water. Ladder 1 and 3 were used for an aerial attack as embers from the burning structure ignited brush between 300 and 1,000 feet away, according to Normandin. There were some transformers over there, so we were concerned about that, he said, but we were able to keep the transformers from catching fire. Images posted to social media showed flames erupting from the building and smoke drifting over the canal. Despite the difficult access and limited water supply, Normandin praised the response. It went well for not having a water supply very close, he said. The firefighters did an excellent job keeping it contained. The fire was reported as knocked down a little more than an hour after the initial call, and no injuries were reported. The cause of the fire remains under investigation, though Normandin said initial indications suggest it started inside the structure before igniting the surrounding brush. Edward Lottie of the Lowell Fire Investigation Unit confirmed that the hydroelectric plant was operational at the time of the blaze. The interior was decimated and one exterior wall was considered unstable. The building is going to be fenced off to keep anyone away from it, Lottie said, and he added that it won't be anything that's rebuilt to my knowledge. Lottie explained that the station operated by drawing water from the Wamasit Canal into the front of the building, where it dropped into the basement to turn a turbine before exiting into the Concord River. Property records show that the station, which was built in 1996, was purchased just months ago in January for $825,000 by Lowell Hydro Power Company, LLC. The facility's operator, Sean Ammon, was on scene assessing the damage. He said he was uncertain about the long-term future of the facility, though his initial belief is that the station is a total loss. The power station was previously in the news nearly 2 years ago when firefighters recovered the body of a man found lodged against the facility's debris capture gate. So, interesting. At least it wasn't started in the brush, I suppose.
Yes.
A bit early for that.
Okay, so I'm going to read the Lowell Sun Sunday paper. Lead article at the top of the fold says, frustrations rise over changes to the Tewksbury Hospital security. And then below it, in a little bit of a smaller print, it says, the Massachusetts police chiefs call for review of the changes. And this is coming out of Tewksbury. That's your hometown.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Officials in Tewksbury have expressed frustration this week over the removal of security tools from the Tewksbury Hospital security team after another meeting with state health officials and another incident involving a patient. I wonder what that means, the removal of security tools. After the Executive Office of Health and Human Services ordered the removal of tools like pepper gel, okay, they removed pepper gel, handcuffs, and batons from the tool belts of the Tewksbury security team specialists at the hospital. Officials in Tewksbury were stunned and immediately sought answers from the state. I mean, so what are they going to use, a pea shooter? You know, get a straw and get little peas? And,
yeah, I'm not sure.
It sounds like you need handcuffs, maybe pepper gel, right? Sounds like, you know, if you're not, you know, are they carrying firearms?
I doubt it.
Okay, so then what are they using then? After a meeting between the state health officials and the Tewksbury officials April 3, the day after the change was announced, those representing Tewksbury felt further frustrated by the state's unwillingness to pause the change for more discussion. Okay, I'm digressing. My wife got her licensed practical nurse license, an LPN license at Tewksbury State Hospital.
Oh, okay.
In 1970, she went on to become a registered nurse. But started there in 1970. Wow. They were having where they put you up in dorms there.
Oh, yeah, yes.
And they gave you food and a stipend to be there, you know. So, okay.
Okay, well.
So she was there in 1970. She could have met you.
Yeah.
Right? Or were you just a little boy then?
I think I was only 14.
Okay. Another meeting took place on Tuesday, followed by officials learning of an incident that morning where a patient is now facing charges for allegedly assaulting staff. How often do we hear that in Tewksbury State Hospital? The patient's assaulting the staff.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people with troubled.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, yeah, okay. We're aware of that. And both only added to the frustration, Select Board member James Mackey told The Sun Thursday afternoon. I've approached this from a collaborative stance because I think this is how we get the most done. But after the second call on Tuesday, we couldn't get confirmation on any actions taken other than that they are willing to listen and monitor the situation. It wasn't until later that Mackey said they learned of the alleged assault that had taken place at the hospital Tuesday, which led to charges for the unidentified patient said to have attacked a staff member. I'm not surprised by this Tuesday issue. I think we're going to see more of this, said Mackey. We don't know what we don't... Wait a minute. We don't know what we don't know. We do know there will be impacts. Okay, Mackey said he wants the select board to consider a number of options, even going as far as exploring the legality of withholding town emergency services or a legal injunction. It's extremely unfortunate. I hate to say I told you so, but everyone saw this coming. Tewksbury Hospital has beds for patients with a mix of cognitive and behavioral health challenges, including forensic patients with varying levels of involvement in criminal justice system. This and the hospital security has been a point of contention in recent years after a number of assaults on staff and forensic patients, usually kept there through the courts, escaping the hospital grounds, requiring a police response. These issues lead to an overhaul of the hospital security system over the last 2 years. I wouldn't want to be living nearby that hospital. Do you live near there?
I don't live too far away, maybe 5 minutes drive away.
Oh, by driving?
Yes.
Not by walking.
There are not a lot of residential houses near that hospital.
Mm. Okay, on Friday, the Massachusetts Chief of Police Association took a step further by issuing a letter to Governor Moore Healey, formally requesting a comprehensive review of recent security policy changes at the hospital. With 478 assaults reported on campus in 2025? That's more than one a day.
Yeah, that's...
Are you serious?
There's some dangerous people in there.
The risks are real and ongoing, said the Tewksbury Police Department in a statement where they posted the MCPA letter. I mean, if I was the Tewksbury Police Department, I'd probably be called, I'd be called there every day, right?
Yeah, I think that they are called regular enough, yeah.
Removing critical tools for de-escalation not only increased danger for the staff and patients, but also places a greater burden on local law enforcement. We strongly believe any policy changes should be informed by the thorough security assessment already completed and guided by the best practices in public safety. The Massachusetts Nurses Association representative and Tewksbury Hospital nurse Ryan Wilkins said union members are absolutely furious at the comments the Department of Public Health Commissioner Robbie Goldstein allegedly made Tuesday, meaning that the unions have been properly consulted in making this change. Contrary to Commissioner Goldstein's claims, we have not been involved in these discussions, said Wilkins to the Sun Thursday. And then the Nurses Association is requesting an emergency meeting to be held between Tewksbury Hospital nurses and the state officials. In a statement Friday, on EOHHS spokesperson said, the health and safety of patients and staff of facilities is our top priority. I don't understand why they would take away the tools to try to manage this. We are incredibly grateful to our... Oh, wait a minute. I have to digress. We're living in Massachusetts. In a statement, we are incredibly grateful to our staff members who prioritize patient care and safety, even in the most difficult of circumstances. Updating this Tewksbury State Hospital security policy to eliminate the use of pepper gel and of the other weapons balances our therapeutic mission with our responsibility to keep patients and staff safe. We are in close communication with local police and actively monitoring the implementation of this policy change to make sure our staff are equipped with the most appropriate tools. They're not telling me what the appropriate tools are.
Hmm.
Are they like in soccer? If you do something flagrantly wrong, do you get like a yellow card or a red card?
I doubt if it's something that simplistic.
Huh?
It can't be that simplistic.
You don't just hand them a red card and say, hey, red card.
I don't think so.
Okay. State Rep. Dave Robertson, who's a Democrat in Tewksbury. You know who he is, Dave Robertson?
I know the name.
Okay. Said Thursday that he intends to bring a copy of the police report from the Tuesday assault to Governor Maura Healey's office to give her a better picture of the situation. It is exactly what we said to them Friday morning when we were all in the first conference call, Robertson said. The justification seems to be to push on standardizing the campus, saying Tewksbury doesn't do this, but it's so ignorant of the reality. Ignorant of the reality and ignorant of the commission that took away the tools. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I don't know what the tools are now, so I can't really comment on
that. Oh, I thought it was the red card and the yellow card.
No, that's your imagination. they can't have... They have to have something that deals with people who are capable of violence.
Right, right.
So they must have something. I don't know what it is.
Well, what do you call the
stun thing? Stun gun?
Stun guns.
I have no idea what they have. So
yeah.
But
well, let's put it this way. You don't want to ever be in there.
I do not want to be in there.
Okay.
So, I got a short police story here, but I do want to mention that there were some elections in the area recently, and I'll very briefly tell you that in Billerica, Select Board member Mike Riley, who was on the board, has returned again after he won the most votes in the election here. So his name is Mike Riley. And then the second person is Mike Rosa, who retained his seat. And it also says that Sandra Giroux will be Billerica's next town clerk after Saturday's election. So that fills you in about that. And also, speaking of Tewksbury, in Tewksbury, John Lombardo won the seat on the select board. He had a commanding lead over his challenger, 1,058 votes to 602, and he will now secure a seat on the select board. And he promises to work together and behaving within an independent mind on the various boards and things that he will be a part of. And before I read this short story, or the police story, I think it have to go without saying, we have to mention that one Rory Gallagher, Rory McIlroy, I got him mixed up with the musician Rory Gallagher, he of Northern Ireland, born there like me, celebrated the victory in the Masters Golf Championship yesterday and became only the fourth person to win back-to-back golf titles at the Masters. So congrats to the Northern Ireland homeboy there, Rory. Want to call him Rory Gallagher, but he is a musician. It's Rory McIlroy. So anyway, on to the...
Well, luckily you're not the engraver on the cup that he wins.
I could have got that wrong. I am a very big fan of Rory Gallagher, the musician, but never mind. This is a different kind of story. It's a very short one here. It comes out of the police. And it says that a Chelmsford man is among five people accused of seeking sex with a minor in Lawrence. And an undercover police sting used a fictitious juvenile escort ad to identify man. A Chelmsford man was among five people arrested on Tuesday in Lawrence after police say they responded to an online escort advertisement they believe was for a minor. The Lowell Police Department identified one of the men as Keith Duane, D-U-A-N-E, 46, who investigators say was among those who arranged to meet what they believed was a juvenile for sexual activity after responding to the undercover advertisement. Police said the operation was carried out by the department's Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit in partnership with the State Police High Risk Victims Unit. As part of the sting, undercover officers posted a fictitious online escort advertisement portraying a juvenile and monitored responses throughout the day. Once officers established an agreement for sexual activity, the men were directed to a South Lawrence address where police took them into custody as they arrived separately, according to the department. In addition to Duane, police arrested Junior Sosa, 44, of Lawrence, Matthew German of Epping, New Hampshire, Mamadou Diallo, 54, of Jefferson, and Anderson Foe, 24, of Lawrence. All five were charged with enticement of a child under 16, sexual conduct with a child under 18, and attempt to commit a crime, with that crime identified as rape. Police said the operation was part of an ongoing effort to reduce demand for the commercial sexual exploitation of minors in the region. And there you have it. So, number one, disturbing that these men were seeking a young child to have activity with. And number two, don't respond to these kind of adverts, I guess.
Well, Well, okay. Well, they're gonna have to live with that for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
And maybe need some treatment. Okay. Front page, Sunday's paper. Housing development mix is driving Lowell forward. And then it says under, there's a picture of a, let's see, it looks like about a 5-story apartment building going up. And it says construction on the site of the Emery, E-M-E-R-Y, a multifamily development on Middlesex Street in Lowell. Well, Middlesex Street is right here, right? Unless it keeps going, it goes way down. By where the Greek restaurant used to be, the Olympia, that way?
Yeah.
Is that Middlesex Street also?
Yeah, well, it runs actually up towards Route 3. It runs, like, not in the same direction as that. It runs, what building is up there.
Okay, so here's the articles coming out of Lowell. In any given time, the majority of personal property owners in Lowell are creating housing of limited scope. I'm going to read that again. In any given time, the majority of personal property owners in Lowell are creating housing of limited scope, building anywhere between 1 to 8 units in the neighborhood throughout the city. These projects all come before the land use boards for variances, special permits, and site plan review approval. According to data compiled by the Department of Planning and Development, almost 100 of these dwelling units were permitted from October of 2024 to October of 25. Okay, but that's 1 to 8 units. I'm looking at this building, and it's like, it's got to be like 20, 30 units in it. In contrast, okay, here it is. In contrast, the same time frame, larger commercial developers permitted almost 500 housing units, ranging from low income to affordable to market rate, as well as first-time home buyers. Some developments are still under review or waiting to break ground, while others, the Emery on Middlesex Street, expect a fall opening. And then it says, Heritage Properties, a locally owned and operated real estate investment, development, and management firm, broke ground on the vacant lot of Middlesex and Pearl Streets last year. I don't know where Pearl Street and Middlesex is.
No, I don't really know that.
And it was a former community garden and herbal farm. Am I pronouncing that? Herbal. Herbal farm. I'll have to look up where Middlesex and Pearl Streets are. The $10 million project features, okay, this is 37 market-rate apartments across 5 floors, 23 studios, 10 one-bedrooms, and 4 two-bedrooms. So that's 37 units. So of the 37 units, you got 23 studios, then you have 10 one-bedrooms, and then you have 4 two-bedrooms. The project draws its name from Lowell's Mill City roots. I have to go to page 5. Wait a minute. Where am I? Page 5? Yeah. Okay. And Emery is a steel roller in a loom. Okay, this is going back. Which aids in gripping the fabric. Okay, so the Emery references Lowell's identity as the Spindle City, with a legacy of textile manufacturing. Heritage Properties sent an email earlier this month. Okay. The Emery will be located in the city's Jackson, Appleton, Middlesex, Urban Renewal Neighborhood Zones. Those aren't good areas, are they?
Well, at least
they're doing something.
They're doing something, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so that's a tough area. In 2025, that location earned Heritage Properties a $2.5 million housing development incentive program tax credit. Boy, that's a long word. For market rate housing championed by the administration of Governor Moore Healey. The Department of Planning and Development said Heritage's project met the housing goals of the Lowell Forward Plan. The city has been trying to revitalize the JAM, J-A-M area. Oh, that must be Jackson Street, Appleton, and Middlesex Street.
Mm-hmm.
That's a That's a rough area there.
It is.
Yeah. On Friday, a reporter visited to the site to find a work crew installing some of the exterior finishes work that Heritage Properties President Jeff Bush said was finally taking place after a tough winter. "We're really excited," he said Friday. "There's a lot of momentum on the street and in the city." Also last year, the residences at the Franco at 357 Pawtucket Street received approval for 80 market-rate housing units in the Acre neighborhood. When they say, at the Franco, I'm thinking of the Franco-American.
Well, I think it was the school, Franco-American school. I think that's what that's all about.
Oh.
Maybe. I'm not really sure.
But that's the area we're talking about, right?
Yeah, probably over there, yeah.
So they received approval for 80 market-rate housing units.
Wow.
Where's everyone parking?
Well, probably underneath the building, maybe.
Oh, okay. In addition, the Lowell Innovation Network corridor is expected to bring nearly 500 units of new market-rate rental units to the city's housing stock on UMass Lowell's East Campus. They're saying market rate. So there's not affordable. This is market.
Market, yeah.
Downtown Lowell has its share of development in March. Cabot, and Forbes received historic board approval for 2 6-story buildings with 362 market rate apartments in the Hamilton Canal Innovation District. Where are all these people going to go? I mean,
well, a lot of people will move out of the old houses around, and
maybe,
I would think.
I didn't think of that. A tantalizing unknown is the future of the Front Runner City Initiative, which the city signed last summer in Geneva, Switzerland. Why do we have to go to Geneva, Switzerland to sign something? With the United Nations-based Urban Economy Forum, front runner status allows Lowell to harness a global pipeline of investment in the fields of finance, construction, and design with the goal to create inclusive, safe, resilient, sustainable communities, including housing. Okay, then there's another part of the article then says the Acre has the greatest diversity of housing stock in the city. In addition to the 32 affordable units that opened in Acre Crossing in 2024, the almost $15 million Suffolk Place development located at 408 Suffolk Street is accepting lottery applications from first-time homeowners for 33 affordable units in this summer. In December, former Executive Office and Housing and Livable Community Secretary Ed Augustus cut the ribbon on 49 affordable housing apartments at 733 Broadway Street, the former headquarters of the Merrimack Valley Food Bank. And the Lowell Housing Authority continues to secure financing for its Merrimack Corridor Development Housing Project. Another 160 affordable housing units are on the drawing board in the city's Acre neighborhood after the zoning board approved Coalition for Batters Acres application in January. Between these and many other projects still in the development phase, Lowell is on track to meet the 800 new affordable housing units built by 2040. Jeff Bush of Heritage Properties said the city administration and the departments helped to make projects like the Emory happen. City manager Tom Golden and his administration have been excellent partners, he said.
Wow, that's a lot of housing.
I know.
That's great. That's great news for Lowell. It deserves it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It does, I think.
Okay. All right. I'll turn it back to you.
Okay. So from another front page story, which, it's not very surprising, but it says that, many in Massachusetts have food insecurity. Food insecurity reached a record high last year, leading to worse health outcomes as households simultaneously grappled with housing and utility costs. Some 40% of Massachusetts households, or 1.12 million people, experienced food insecurity at some point over the past 12 months, according to a report released Tuesday by the Greater Boston Food Bank and Mass General Brigham. And this compares to 37% in 2024, which isn't very good, and about 700,000 households in 2025 experienced very low food security, which happens when a person must skip meals or not eat all day because they cannot afford food. The report is based on a survey of more than 3,000 adults from October to December. Over the past 6 years, Hispanic households have dealt with the highest rates of food insecurity, with levels reaching 63% in 2025, according to this report. The data clearly shows that hunger in Massachusetts is on the rise, says Dr. Lauren Fischner, a Mass General Brigham Division Chief and Senior Health and Research Advisor at the Food Bank. Our results are sobering. More people are struggling. And while they report assessing food and nutrition assistance, programs like food pantries, SNAP, and WIC, they also say these programs are not enough. Some 75% of families receiving SNAP benefits said they still need additional support. Recipients could soon face bigger challenges as, of course, funding cuts and work requirements take effect under the federal so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The report suggests bolstering state funding for SNAP with the aim of decreasing a payment error rate that could cost Massachusetts around $350 million annually. Just over half of the residents were also relying on charitable food and nutrition assistance programs for at least half of their groceries. Households experiencing food insecurity on average said they needed an additional $500 monthly to meet their basic expenses. The report found that 46% of food insecure households had also trouble paying for heat and electricity, and only about 1 in 2 households had stable housing. Nearly 8 in 10 adults living in food insecure households had at least one chronic medical condition, such as obesity, diabetes, dental or gum disease, cardiovascular disease, and mental health issues. And among those who had to forgo care, 67% reported skipping prescriptions and 40% skipped dental care. In food insecure households, turnover, with children, 21% of people reported times when their child couldn't access medical or dental care due to costs. Individuals in food-insecure households were twice as likely to go to the emergency department or be hospitalized. The estimated excess costs of hospitalization associated with food insecurity were up $13,257 per adult, the report said. And it's also, in 2025, is associated with up to $1.6 billion in emergency room visits and hospitalizations. The report calls for boosting funding for the Massachusetts Energy Food Assistance Program, which provides direct support to the Greater Boston Food Bank that's then distributed to other food banks and pantries around the state. Governor Maura Healey has proposed funding the account at $55 million in fiscal 2027. Other recommendations entail ramping up food as medicine initiatives that are aimed at preventing and treating diet-related illnesses, strengthening food insecurity screenings, and referrals for people to connect with support systems, programs, and investing in local food systems. So, in the greatest country in the world, people are hungry.
It's hard to believe. It really is. I don't understand it.
I don't know how it's hard to believe. People are getting working in low-paying jobs, and their rents and utilities and food costs have gone up in the last 2 years. There's no doubt about it. I don't see how there's a doubt about it.
But I mean, the government should be making sure that people have food stamps, whatever is necessary.
Well, not the federal government that we have now. Right? They don't care. But anyway.
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, that's sad. Okay, that's a sad story. I mean, you know, when you're growing up as a kid, that's not one of the things you should be worrying about.
No.
Oh, that is sad. Okay, I'm back to the front page of the Lowell Sun. Here's the last front page article. It says, cousins tied to the Asian Boys, B-O-Y-Z. I guess that's a gang, right?
Must be.
admit roles in meth-filled counterfeit Adderall scheme. And it says here, Owen Landry and Zachary Hansen, I guess they're cousins, pleaded guilty to distributing thousands of pills containing meth. You know, I don't have any sympathy for them. I have sympathy for people who go hungry. FaceTime video. Oh, hold on. Hold on. This is crazy. Hold on. And this is coming out of Boston. Two Lowell cousins with ties to the Asian Boys have pleaded, and that's B-O-Y-Z, have pleaded guilty in federal court to trafficking thousands of counterfeit Adderall pills containing methamphetamine, marking the latest development in a year-long investigation into the gang's drug network. Owen Landry, 24, a confirmed member of ABZ, which I assume is Asian Boys Z, okay, yeah. And Zachary Hansen, 31, a gang associate, worked together to distribute thousands of meth-filled pills by taking part in a trafficking operation that used Hansen's home as a stash and distribution site and relied on sales arranged by Landry, according to U.S. Attorney Lee Foley's office. Prosecutors said the cousins conspired with another ABZ member, Savath Yearn, of Billerica to profit from bulk sales of the fake Adderall pills. In July, first of all, who would buy these pills? If you're buying pills illegally, wouldn't you suspect that they're not what they are being advertised as?
I don't know. I guess drug addicts.
In July in August of 2024, Landry arranged two large pill deals and directed buyers to the local residents, unaware that both transactions were part of the undercover law enforcement operation. In the first deal, a cooperating witness met Hansen inside the home and paid him $2,000 for 5,000 pills. A month later, another witness paid the same amount for 2,000 pills. While, I have to go to page 6, while the investigators observed a co-conspirator moving back and forth between the house and the buyer. Later in 2024, Landry allegedly began sourcing pills directly from Yearn's apartment in Billerica. On two occasions in late 2024, Landry met a cooperating witness in the apartment garage, took cash payments, and then entered the building with Yearn. Prosecutors said Landry was seen going into Yearn's apartment with the money and leaving with the large bags of pills before returning to deliver 4,000 pills in November 24 and 5,000 pills in 2025. Landry pleaded guilty on Wednesday. Okay, to conspiracy to distribute 500 grams or more of methamphetamine, possession with the intent to distribute the same amount, and two counts of distributing 50 grams or more. He's scheduled to be sentenced on July 8. Hansen pleaded guilty on March 31 to conspiracy to distribute 500 grams or more of methamphetamine and possession with the intent to distribute that amount. His sentencing is set for March 31st, 2027. Really?
Hmm.
That's a year from now.
Yeah.
Landry's attorney, Austin Zhang, and Hansen's attorney, Monica Shah, were not immediately available. The two cousins, along with Yearn, were among the six men arrested in January of 2025 when federal authorities unsealed a second wave of indictments targeting alleged members and associates of ABZ. The other three other men include Isaiah Tank, or Rozzy Lyons, Richard Cheese Nguyen, and Scott Fournier, each of Lowell. Yearn's case is still moving through the federal courts, while Fournier received a 10-year prison sentence in November after pleading guilty to drug distribution. So if you get 10 years, right, you probably only have to do half, or you have to do two-thirds?
I don't know.
Like 7 years, you're going to go away?
Good behavior or whatever?
Jurors found Lyons and Nguyen guilty of offenses connected to the counterfeit pill ring. Lyons is scheduled to be sentenced on April 21, while Nguyen was sentenced early this month to 10 years and 8 months in prison. The arrest stemmed from a federal investigation launched in 2021 to disrupt the gang's manufacturing and distribution of homemade methamphetamine pills circulating in Lowell. The first wave of indictments came in July of 2023 when 9 members and associates of ABZ were arrested on drug trafficking and firearm charges, including the transfer of machine gun conversion devices. Oh, gosh. Of the 9 defendants, 7 were from Greater Lowell. They include, they all have, like, nicknames. They include Sari Bad Guy Wrath, Bad Guy, of Lowell, who was sentenced to 11 years in prison. Bill Bonsney Fim of Lowell, who received a 10-year sentence. Brian Cheech Gingrich of Lowell, who was sentenced to 9 years. Erickson Silent Deo, they all have little nicknames, of Lowell, who received 7 years. And Joseph Bagrowski of Chelmsford, who was sentenced to time served. Well, he didn't have a middle name, so I guess he got less of a sentence. Two other Lowell men, Samang Smiley Sun and Billy Jujitsu, or Juju Shan, have pleaded guilty and are awaiting sentence. According to the prosecutors, more than 57,000 counterfeit Adderall pills containing over 18 kilograms of methamphetamine were seized and purchased during the course of the investigation. Unbelievable.
Great country we live in.
Ah, please.
So, anyway, this is a story, a local news section. Actually, comes out of the Granite State, out of Nashua. And the headline says, Merrimack dodged an icy bullet, and ICE, ice, is in capital letters. You could say that Southern New Hampshire dodged a bullet by stopping the nation's immigration and customs enforcement, known as ICE, from converting a large warehouse in Merrimack into an immigration detention and processing center. The facility would have temporarily held up to 1,500 immigrants, serving as part of a national network aimed at speeding up deportations. The town of Merrimack fought back hard at the grassroots level, gaining tremendous momentum. New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte later stepped in and flew to Washington to meet with Department of Homeland Security and returned, assuring Granite Staters that the ICE warehouse Christmas surprise of 2025 was a no-go. ICE had backed off. If you think ICE is softening its stance in 2026, you're probably mistaken. Armed with $85 billion in new funding, let me say that again, $85 billion in new funding. That would feed a lot of hungry people. Mm. President Donald Trump has called for ICE to expand its footprint across America to retrofit more warehouses into detention spaces. And this boggles the mind if the numbers can be believed. These detention facilities now hold nearly 70,000 immigrants. That scale has not been seen since the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans and nationals during World War II. Of course, based upon fear of Japan, which was a dangerous enemy at the time. Many Americans, including those from the Granite State, are against ICE's aggressive mass deportations because they're often pursuing the wrong people and tearing families apart. Most of the individuals being hauled away in handcuffs are not the, quote, bad hombres that President Trump mentioned during a 2016 presidential debate. "We have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out," he said, while discussing immigration and border security. However, she says, if we deal with the facts, the latest statistics show that the majority, 73.6%, of ICE detainees have no criminal convictions. Other New Hampshire residents have, however, strongly support the Trump administration's increased efforts to remove those who have entered this country illegally, no ifs, ands, or buts. Nashua is stepping out ahead of the curve to assure all Gate City residents that they're welcome here and to quietly remind ICE to play by the rules when enforcing federal law, ensuring that it prioritizes transparency, clear identification, and de-escalation, and that minimizes unnecessary fear or disruption to the public. The legislation proposed by Alderwoman-at-Large Shoshana Kelly and Alicia Gregg will be up for a final approval by the full Board of Aldermen at their meeting on Tuesday, April the 14th, tomorrow. Is this resolution even necessary? Isn't it just a paper declaration that holds no legal power, she says? Maybe so. But a number of Nashuans have told Alderman Kelly that now they don't always feel comfortable attending public events for fear that they could be targeted by ICE just because of their cultural backgrounds or their skin color. It's genuine fear, and for Kelly, she wants residents and visitors to know and hear from officials out loud that we see you, we understand, and we all want to feel safe here. Nashua has always been a welcoming and diverse community, and as the proposed resolution states, that whose residents include immigrants, refugees, longtime residents, workers, students, families, and business owners who contribute to the social, cultural, and economic life of the city. One only has to look through the pages of history, going back, she says, to 1946, to see how the Gate City was ahead of the nation. When Hall of Fame catcher, the baseball player Roy Campanella, and Cy Young Award-winning pitcher Don Newcomb joined the Nashua Dodgers, establishing the minor league club as the first racially integrated baseball team in the United States. Did not know that. That was a huge pride moment and a game changer in more than just the sport of baseball. Well written.
Well, okay.
Break.
Okay, do you you walk your neighborhood? I walk my neighborhood in the morning.
Break time?
Oh, I thought he was going to do break dancing. Oh, no. Oh, okay. Yeah, I got lost in this.
Okay.
This is going to be my article after the break.
Okay.
It talks about bears in the neighborhood.
Oh.
Okay, so we're at the mid-show break. And you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. And the Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. As Paul reminded me, we're going to take our 15-minute break. And we will be back. Okay, we are back. And I think it's my turn to read.
Yeah, it is, because
I got this article that I wanted to read because it kind of concerned me because I'm a walker in my neighborhood. So, again, let me just tell you, you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. And Paul is reading today's Lowell Sun, and I'm reading yesterday, Sunday's Lowell Sun. And here's the article that concerned me a little bit because I walk my neighborhood as my exercise in the early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it says, wicked, hungry bears roaming. That's kind of scary when they say wicked, hungry. And I'm walking down my street, and it's kind of a lot of woods around there.
Yeah.
It says, and then it says, I don't know how they know this, so Paul's going to enlighten me. They say around 5,000 black bears live in the Bay State. Now, how do they know that?
I think they just big estimations based upon reports from people who see them. People are walking in the woods, you know, and
how did they come up with 5,000? Why didn't they say 1,000? Why didn't they say 100?
Because there's a massive increase, I think, in bear populations over the last few years.
Okay.
People are seeing it, I think, you know.
All right. So I don't know what to do because there's a lot of woods where I walk. It says, now here's the article. As hungry, and they got hungry in italics, as hungry black bears emerge from hibernation, it's time to press pause, P-A-W-S, and make sure you take steps to keep, well, isn't the word pause supposed to be P-A-U-S-E? Not P-A-W-S?
Well, they're using...
Unless it's just...
They're okay.
It's time to press pause instead of spelling it right, and make sure you take steps to keep the large animals away from your home and neighborhood. Okay. Do you think I ought to get bear spray?
Well, all I know is, from what I know, don't have bird feeders.
Well, I don't need to read this article. That's the message from Mass Wildlife as thousands of black bears leave their winter dens and seek out food. Wildlife officials have gotten reports in recent weeks of bears killing chickens. Oh, maybe I ought to be walking a chicken and then knowing that the bear's not going to want me. Wildlife officials have gotten reports in recent weeks of bears killing chickens. They, black bears, haven't eaten for 4 to 5 months.
Hibernation, yeah.
You'd be hungry, too.
Yeah, you would be. Your belly would be empty.
So they're very hungry and out looking for food. Said Dave Waddles, a black bear and fur bear biologist. That's some title, huh?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of natural food out there, so they're drawn to any food around our homes, he added. So it's really important for the public to make changes to their behaviors and remove food sources so bears are not around their homes, which can lead to conflicts. Around 4,500 to 5,000 black bears. Now they've got a range. Live in Massachusetts, and their range is expanding eastward. Removing bird feeders. Did you remove those? You read this article?
I told you that's the main one. The bird
residents feeder. With bird feeders should take them down. Waddles stress as thousands of bears emerge from hibernation. It's just little bird seed. What are they doing?
Doesn't matter.
What is that? Like an appetizer?
Well, you know. I don't know.
Bears will often ignore seasonally available natural foods like acorns or nuts in favor of the easy meal as backyard bird feeder. Bird feeders are basically the gateway drug where they're training bears to come to backyards.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, boy, maybe I did not put my bird feeders out. They train them that the best place to find food is right next to your home, so they get more comfortable there, and that leads to breaking into sheds and garages.
That's fun.
Other species, including wild turkeys and coyotes, may also frequent bird feeders, which can lead to more human-wildlife conflict. Beyond bird feeders, residents need to protect backyard chickens, hives, and other small livestock. This season, there have already been reports of bears killing chickens in Worcester County. Chickens are an easy source of food for bears. Every single bear will take advantage of these meals. Co-ops? Is that what you said? Or coops and chicken wire provide inadequate protection from the black bears. Yeah, oh, so you put up chicken wire. That isn't going to stop them.
They're just going to stomp through that.
People should secure beehives, chickens, and livestock with properly installed and maintained electric fencing. We're begging anyone to be using electric fencing. It's the only thing that will protect you from backyard livestock. People also need to secure other human-associated food sources, including by storing your garbage in closed containers in a garage or outbuilding. Where do you put your garbage?
My garage.
In a barrel?
Yeah, inside the garage.
Inside the garage, okay. Yeah. Residents should bring their garbage out to the curb on the morning of the pickup. Well,
that's what I do.
I'd bring it out the day before, you know, and the reason is because sometimes those guys come like at 8:30, and if I forget.
Yeah.
You know. Also, compost responsibly by not putting meat scraps, greasy, oily, or sweet materials in your compost pile. You have a compost pile?
Yeah, I do.
Got to be careful what you put in there.
Well, it's in it. That's a barrel also that you spin.
Oh.
So it's closed.
Oh. Clean grills after each use. I do that.
Yeah.
I do that. Mm. And do not leave food scraps, grease containers, or spilled grease in your yard. If you come across a bear in your yard or nature, okay, this could be me walking, slowly back up and give the bear space. Do not approach bears. I'm not going to approach a bear. Or get between a female bear and her cubs. I'm not going to do that either.
Whoa.
Also, do not run.
Yep.
Don't try to get closer to take a photo. Who would be stupid to do that? Let the bear do its thing before it wanders away. Fight back if a bear makes contact with you. Well, that's what I'm saying. Should I be having a little canister of bear?
It might
spray?
Make it angry, though.
Oh. Also, supervise your pets outdoors. Maybe I should walk with one of my neighbors with his dog.
Yeah, because...
Because at least he'll go after the dog, I would think.
Or the barking might scare the bear off.
Yeah, but one of my neighbors has this little dog. I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Also, supervise your pets outdoors. The presence of a dog could trigger a bear to be aggressive. Hey, that just said to be aggressive. Check your yard for bears before letting your dog outside. Keep dogs leashed when they're outside and never let dogs chase or interact with bears. Yeah, here, Fido, go get that bear. You know.
No.
In most situations, if left alone, the bear will return to the forest on its own. If a bear is in a populated area, contact the Environmental Police Radio Room at 1-800-632-8075 or the nearest Mass Wildlife District office to report the sighting. Can you imagine I'm seeing a bear and I got to look up a phone number? I'm dialing 911, right?
Yeah, well, as long as you have service.
Environmental police or Mass Wildlife will provide advice and determine if a response from the large animal response team is necessary. In most cases, bears in residential areas do not need a response and will leave the area on their own. I always wonder, when I'm walking down my street, it's the end of a cul-de-sac. And then there's woods.
Yeah.
I'm in Draycott. I'm in East Draycott. So there's a lot of woods. And every once in a while at the bottom of that street before I get down to the, you know, at the end, I see a coyote cutting across the street.
Yeah.
And not a fox. I've seen foxes, but a coyote. And I'm like, oh my God. But the coyote just keeps moving away. But
unless it's rabid.
Yeah. Unless it's rabid, then there's a problem. So sometimes I wonder what I should be doing.
Well,
I don't know. Should I buy some kind of a spray?
I feel it might make it more angry. I don't know. But I don't want to digress too much, but I personally have a story about a bear. I was hiking on Route 2 through the woods, and it was after a serious flooding. And a lot of it was water bound, But anyway, I went into the woods, and then I couldn't cross over a brook. And I said, oh, I have to give up this hike because my car was parked in the parking lot, and it was only one way in and one way out. So I'm walking back, and I come around the corner down through the trees, and ahead of me appeared out of another walk space a bear, a black bear, about 100 feet in front of me. And I froze, and the bear, if it had turned right, would have been coming towards me, but unfortunately for me, it turned left, going out towards the parking lot. So I gathered myself.
Where your car is.
Yeah. So it went that direction. So I went back the way I came, settled myself down, and said, what am I going to do? Find a nice big branch. I tried to call the state police. There was no service because it was in the middle of the woods. And I had no choice but to go out the way I came back in. And I was had my eyes pinned and everywhere. But fortunately, the bear had taken off somewhere else, and I did not see it again. But it was a little bit frightening because it was a big one. It was pretty big.
Okay, but, what is the moral of the story?
The moral of the story is nothing, is that I got lucky.
Oh, I thought you might say I now carry more than pea shooter in my pocket.
No, I have not. I still go out in the woods and I don't have anything.
Are you allowed to bring a firearm into the woods?
I probably not. Well, probably, yeah, probably, yeah. If you're a registered gun owner.
Well, I am.
Yeah. I would think so.
But then they would say, you fired your firearm in a residential area.
Yeah.
Well, if the bear was coming down my street.
In a residential area, yeah.
I'd be like, yeah, but I was trying to save my life.
Yeah, well, you might get away with that because you're trying to save you're scared, you know.
Oh, my God. Just.
But I'll tell you, that bear was big. But anyway, that's my bear story.
And what time do you remember the time of the year?
It was, what time of the year was that? I think it was October.
Oh, well, the bears are not hungry then. Yeah. I mean, they're just getting, they're trying to bulk up for the hibernation.
And it was just right after, we had a really serious rain events in Massachusetts where rivers were flooding. And I could have gotten out of this walk if the walkway, but the whole area was flooded in water. So there was no other way. In fact, I had to stop my hike because I couldn't cross this brook.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that's my bear story.
Well.
So, anyhow.
All right.
Let's look at the Beacon Hill Roll Call, which is this part of the Lowell Sun today, which deals with the kind of policies that our representatives are looking at in Boston at the State House. And the first one is alcohol donations for charities.
Wait a minute. Alcohol donations for charity?
Yes. Yes. The House approved and sent to the Senate legislation that would allow local licensing authorities to issue temporary licenses to charities in order for the charities to accept donations of wine, beer, and alcohol for their charitable events. These licenses were previously allowed under 1997 legislation, but the authorization has since expired. Representative Joan Machino, a Democrat from Hull, says, today more than ever, nonprofits are in need of charitable donations to stay afloat, she says. The next one is to protect the rights of homeless individuals. The Judiciary Committee held a public hearing on legislation that will prevent the punishment of individuals experiencing homelessness for conducting life-sustaining activities on public property when no shelter is available. The measure also prohibits discrimination in the use of public areas based solely on housing status and affirms rights such as the right to practice faith, and the right against unreasonable search and seizure for individuals experiencing homelessness in public areas. I filed this bill in response to the U.S. Supreme Court's 2024 Johnson versus Grant's past decision, which allowed communities to penalize people for life-sustaining activities in public when no alternatives exist, said the sponsor, Lindsay Sabadosa, a Democrat from Northampton. These policies effectively criminalize homelessness, impose burdensome fines, and make it harder for people to secure stable housing without improving public health or safety. Our approach prioritizes directing resources towards real public safety needs and lasting housing solutions. Next one, last couple here, is strengthen mental health support for students. The administration of Governor Healey announced it is soliciting innovative ideas from educators, providers, and community partners on how to strengthen the mental health support for Bay State students from birth through higher education. The administration seeks this input while it is currently developing a framework that will guide a coordinated statewide strategy to strengthen mental health support in Massachusetts, improving alignment among early education providers, K-12 schools, higher education institutions, families, and community-based service systems. This is an opportunity for practitioners, community organizations, researchers, and educators to help shape the future of student mental health in Massachusetts, said Education Secretary Stephen Zreek. We're looking for bold, thoughtful ideas that are grounded in evidence and centered in equity and built to last. And the last one is they're proposing health care for state workers. The House and Senate approved and sent Governor Healey a bill that would provide $300 million for health insurance coverage for the 460,000 public employees, retirees, and dependents who access health care through the state's Group Insurance Commission. Supporters said that these additional funds are necessary because of the higher-than-anticipated utilization and pharmaceutical expenses. Health care is a fundamental promise we make to the public employees, retirees, and families who keep our Commonwealth running, said Senate President Spilka. Today, the legislature acted together to ensure that more than 460,000 people can continue to access the care they rely on without any disruption. So that's quite a lot of public employees, 460,000.
Yes, it is. All right, here's some Lowell news. It shows a woman. There's a picture here of a building, and it looks like one of the old mills that's all boarded up. And you can see a big smokestack next to it. So it's one of these old mills. Ooh. And it says at somewhere in a little bit of an alleyway of the mill, it shows a woman sleeps in the outdoor cellar area of the Boyden Turbine Building of Lowell Community Charter School on April 10, 2026. So that was just, you know, the other day. Yeah. The four-month winter protocol ended March 31st, when unhoused people must exit shelter services. So people have to get out of shelter services on March 31st. And now they're showing some woman living in the cellar area of the mill. Sad. So here's the article. It says winter protocol ends. So winter protocol means they can stay in the shelters. Homeless crisis returns. Winter protocol ended March 31st. Didn't know they had such a thing. Did you?
Yeah, because I think the weather.
I understand. But I didn't know they had something where you could stay, you know.
Oh, well, yeah, I think it's, because of the winter.
Which means that the extra beds that the sheltered homeless people overnight are gone until November. In the winter, the Lowell Transitional Living Center on Middlesex Street keeps its lobby open for daytime warmth, okay? But the largest provider of services to adult homeless people north of Boston makes the majority of its clients hit the streets during the day after the protocol ends. So you come in during the day, but you got to hit the road, Jack.
Yeah, if you go over to that Middlesex area, you'll see plenty of people walking around.
So where do they go? A visit to the downtown Lowell and back central neighborhoods, think South Common. You know where South Common is. That's by Gallagher Station, right?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Gorham Street by the Lowell Housing Authority.
Yep.
And Appleton Street.
Same.
At South Street. We're filled with people ambling along the sidewalks or stretched out along the benches on the parkland. Some were hidden away, including a woman sleeping in an outdoor cellar-like area adjacent to the Boyden Turbine Building at the Lowell Community Charter Public School next door to the shelter. Yeah, they got a picture of it. So she slept right below a request for permit sign for the school's new gymnasium, just steps from the school's fenced-in playground. Given the shelter size, it provides emergency housing to at least 90 homeless adults each night and 48 single-room occupancy units that are part of the agency's supportive housing program. It's not unexpected that the area is a magnet for unhoused people. Friday morning, the stench, oh boy, the stench of urine in front of the shelter was overpowering. Despite the mild temperatures that didn't get past 65 degrees, and it's only April, numerous people were seen disappearing into an alleyway-like path behind the shelter. Perhaps there is a back entrance to the complex. To date, Lowell has not figured out how to accommodate its homeless population while also holding its providers accountable for its property. Okay, so when they say the provider's accountable for its property, in other words, you got to maintain the property, you got to pay taxes.
Yep.
Of course, once those clients are off the property, if in fact they are even clients of the shelter, they become the responsibility of residents, businesses, organizations, and even schools in the neighborhood. You know, they, when they say responsible, that's where they hang out. Okay, all right, here's the next article. These are the short articles. Blue Shamrock. You ever hear of that?
Yeah, the bar. Yeah.
Leaves Lowell. That's what it says. Well, blue. Well, okay, let's see what it's speaking. Speaking of accountability, in addition to its numerous alleged violations of the city's license commission rules and regulations, the Blue Shamrock pub and restaurant looks like it might be due for a building inspection. Numerous windows on the second floor are either broken or boarded up. Where is that? Is it on Middle Street?
No, the side street here where I cross to go to the parking garage, it's on the left at the end of the
street. Isn't that called Middle Street? Your Market Street is where you're parking. Then the street in between.
It's right across the road from the parking garage.
Yeah.
On the corner.
Yeah, okay. Numerous windows on the second floor are either broken or boarded up. The building sits on the corner of Palmer and Market.
Yeah,
Palmer and Market Streets in Lowell Downtown Business District, an area that the city is trying to revitalize through a business improvement district initiative. Mm. The broken windows theory suggests that visible signs of physical decay in a community, such as broken windows, trash, graffiti, the pungent smell of human waste, trash, perhaps, and other disorder issues creates an environment that can lead to more social disorder and an increase in crime. Oh, they're even showing a picture of it. The Lowell Police Department is arguing that that's already happening. In addition to multi-year plans with steering committees and consultants and lots of discussion among stakeholders, maybe also enforce broken window type violations with the building code inspection and strengthening Lowell's curb appeal. Okay. So Okay, then the next update here, it says Riverwalk update. The update on the closed Riverwalk is there is nothing new to, I have to go to page four, to report, except that while the Mullins Management Company doesn't seem to be able to fix or secure the falling down building, it did construct a new and improved and locking steel gate, which replaced the fallen down chain link fencing, blocking access to the community path. I don't know where this.
Oh, walk. I know where it is. I used to go on that walk, and then they shut it down because part of the old mill building fell down onto the path and into the river.
That section of the path between Boot Mills and the Lowell Memorial Auditorium was closed in March of 2024 after the facade fell off the adjacent building behind the Mass Mills apartment building. Its reopening is not expected until at least, can you wait until 2030?
That's ridiculous. I'm very sad about that.
Okay, next short article says, saving the best for last. Last month, the Sea Dog Brewing Company, you ever hear of that?
Yeah, that's going to open up near the baseball stadium there in Lowell.
Yeah. This company removed the Jeffy shipping container from the front of the restaurant located in the East Campus area of UMass Lowell. The Cabot Street restaurant is the ninth location of the craft brewing and pub experience business. Workers were on the site Friday continuing the build out for a hope for summer opening. So it's not open yet.
No.
Sea Dog signs hang over the entrance and banners are attracted to street poles out front. It's happening, folks. I think I've driven by there.
Yeah, I used to go in there called the brewery.
Now it's called the Sea Dog.
Yeah.
Okay, next article. A bill, B-I-L-L in capital, is moving through the state legislature to impose a ban on children using social media in the state.
Good.
I think everybody's heard that. It's saying, a Senate bill passed the Massachusetts House on Wednesday in a 129-25 vote, mainly along party lines, with the majority of Democrats supporting it. Kids under 14 would be outright prohibited on paper from using social media, while parental control consent would be required for 14 and 15-year-olds. It would also impose a ban on the use of cell phones in schools across the strait. I have a question, and I don't know the answer to this. How do they enforce it?
Well, they've already got ways of making them put their phone in a closed box.
But when you're not in school.
Oh, when you're not in school.
How do you enforce them not to be on social media? I'm a 13-year-old. How do you enforce that?
I thought that was only for at school, that bill, no? It's a general one?
Oh, I don't. Okay. The creeping influence of social media and instant communication has been affecting all of us over the last three or four decades. Okay. The cell phone ban in school should be relatively simple.
Schools.
That's simple. I think this is, they're saying you can't be on social media if you're 13 and younger in the state. It has nothing to do with school.
Nothing
you can't
to
bring
do.
Your cell phone.
Okay.
School. Okay.
Parents.
Okay. Wait a minute. Yeah, you're right. Enforcing a ban on social media, though, is where things get turned tricky. Yes, here we go. Mm-hmm. And a little, in order to prohibit certain age groups from accessing social media, you have to identify who is in certain age groups. How do you do that? You have to get everybody's age group, even the grown-ups, and proving one's age in these settings is like submitting an ID. So if you went on, like, some special social media, you'd have to show them your ID. It goes without saying that social media has been more of a negative than a positive. You would agree with that.
Yes, I think so.
So I just don't know how they're going to do it. I don't know. It says you would just be asking for a mass identity theft event I don't know how this is ever going to be enforceable.
Yep,
so, okay. Really. Okay, here's the next one. Full circle farm bill, whatever that means. The Massachusetts Senate passed bill number 3029, also known as the Farm Fostering Agricultural Resilience in Massachusetts bill on April 1, my birthday. And within its text is a small full circle moment for recently elected State Senator Vanna Howard. Howard jumped from the House. I don't want to read that. Doesn't sound interesting. Okay, here's Drake it Gadfly. Okay, it's something to do with Drake it. All right? So Drake it Gadfly, John Zimini, recently penned a 1,700-word post on Facebook with an opening that sounded like he was giving up his involvement in town politics. I don't even know who he is. He is now a resident of New Hampshire. So why, he asks, would he continue his involvement in the town he no longer lives in? Many people have asked him where he's been for the last several months. He addressed that question fairly quickly, but what followed seemed like a reflection on his years in town. The tone of the post was not forward-looking, so it was a surprise when 1,600 words after he began, he concluded with the words, "Let the games begin. Soon I will expose who stands where and ask some pointed questions." As this is being written, there is no sign of political explosion, the sort of thing that Zimini contributed to the last fall, but others have created their own turmoil on social media. What's going on at Drake? And here's the last one. The Drake at School Committee continues to be suspicious and critical of town manager Kate Hodges. Okay. And Finance Committee member Rich Conan has uploaded pages of budget material to his social media platform. Drake at Civic Watch sharing the issues he has with the budget. At issue is the latest social media kerfuckle. Kerfuckle? Is that how you say it? Kerfuckle? The draft budget Hodges delivered to the school committee had a $4 million error. The $4 million error occurred in the funding for the employer's share of health plan costs for active and retired employees. An example pointed out that the cost for a single retiree plan for health care was between $9,000 and $11,000. For fiscal 27, the amount had rocketed to $150,000 per plan. Cowan blamed some of the problem on the understaffing at town hall. So I think it cost $9,000 or $11,000 to have medical health care for retirees before they get to Medicare.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me. You know what? I guess we're all in a hole in Drakeet.
Yeah.
I think we're $9 or $10 million in the hole.
Yeah, that's what they said the other week. So
should I get my wallet out? Because they're coming for it.
Yeah,
or should I hide it?
No, they're coming.
They're coming. There's no hiding it, right?
You're not hiding it. You're not.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Before I get further depressed.
Yeah.
But, take over, Paul.
I'm sure everyone listening has heard our coverage about the Artemis flight to the moon or around the moon. And I know everybody has different opinions upon the worthiness of this, but let me read this story to you, and you'll see what the future holds. And it says that NASA already has a next Artemis flight in its sights after the moon flyby. Never before glimpsed views of the moon's far side, check. Total solar eclipse gracing the lunar scene, check. And now, distance record for humanity, check. With NASA's lunar comeback, a galactic-sized smash thanks to Artemis II, the world is wondering, what's next? And how do you top that? To people all around the world who look up and dream about what is possible, the long wait is over, says NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman, as he introduced Artemis II Commander Reid Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Canada's Jeremy Hansen at Saturday's jubilant homecoming celebration. Now that the first lunar travelers in more than a half century are safely back in Houston, NASA has Artemis 3 in its sights. The next mission's right around the corner, Flight Director Rich Hanfling observed following the crew's Pacific flashdown on Friday. In a mission recently added to the docket for next year, Artemis 3's yet-to-be-named astronauts will practice docking their Orion capsule with a lunar lander or two in orbit around the Earth. Of course, guess who steps in here? Elon Musk's SpaceX and Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin are racing to have their company's lander ready first. Musk's Starship and Bezos' Blue Moon are vying for the all-important Artemis 4 moon landing in 2028. Two astronauts will aim for the South Polar region, the preferred location for Isaacman's envisioned 20 billion to 30 billion moon base. Vast amounts of ice are almost certainly hidden in permanently shadowed craters there, ice that could provide water and rocket fuel. I'll use your method, David, here. How do they know that? The docking mechanism for Artemis 3's close-to-home trial run is already at the Florida's Kennedy Space Center. The latest model Starship is close to launching on a test flight from South Texas, and a scaled-down version of Blue Moon will attempt a lunar landing later this year. NASA promises to announce the Artemis 3 crew soon, and like 1969's Apollo 9, Artemis 3 aims to reduce risk for the moon landings that follow. Apollo 9 astronaut Rusty Schweikart loved flying that lunar module in low Earth orbit. A test pilot's dream, he said. But there's no question, he noted, that the real astronauts, at least in the public's mind, were the ones who walked on the moon. Wiseman and his crew put their passion and feeling on full display as they flew around the moon and back, choking up over lost loved ones as well as those left behind on Earth. During their nearly 10-day journey, they tearfully requested that a fresh, bright lunar crater be named after Wiseman's late wife, Carol, who died of cancer in 2020. And they also openly shared their love for one another and planet Earth, an exquisite yet delicate oasis in the black void, they said, that they said needs better care. Let me finish by just posing a question. How much money, how many millions and billions of dollars do these moon flights cost? I nobody ever tells you that.
I was thinking the same thing when we were reading about people that don't have enough food to eat, and we're spending billions, and that we could be spending that to better ourselves here on this planet.
And of course, it's the rich aristocratic guys like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos who are racing to get their, their things.
Yeah. But I do, you asked the question, how do I know that there's ice on the moon? I do know. The guys that counted the 5,000 bears are the same ones that said that there are ice. Yeah.
The only thing I can think of is that when they did land on the moon way back in the day, Apollo, that they took samples out of the moon's surface and it gave indications of
I'm not sure where they landed. I think they're talking about at the poles of the moon.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know.
I don't know about you, but the pictures that I saw, it just looked like a big black piece of coal.
That's great. Well, okay, on that, we're going to end our broadcasting. And we want to thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. Excuse me. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Three ways to listen to us. One is go to our website, LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Another one is to dial this phone number, 1-631-359-9069. A third way is give us a call at the lab at 978-454-5704, and I think we could give you a free specialized radio receiver. So there are three ways. We want to thank you. We rebroadcast at 4 p.m. tomorrow at 9 o'clock, 9 in the morning. We rebroadcast new articles from the local newspapers. So I'm going to switch you back to Marshfield Broadcasting, and I want to say thank you once again, Paul.
Yes, David, thank you. And
we will not be here next Monday.
Oh.
Because that is the marathon day, Patriots Day.
Oh, Patriots Day, okay.
Yeah. So
I did not realize that.
Yeah, so do not come in. You can come in, but nobody's going to be here. The doors are going to be locked. So, okay.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. All right.